I kind of grew up in the church. And so that was Bruce Springsteen, you know, Write What You Know. And so that was the world that I knew. And so the songs would come out that way, you know, and a lot of people would look at the Jars sort of spiritual content trajectory and go, wow, they've really like it. It shifted a lot over the years. And I think that was just us moving from a space of, you know, being young kids and having a very kind of simple idea of what faith was like, and then living a little bit, seeing the world, butting up against other cultures and other ideas, and realizing that the things that we thought were so simple and easy really weren't.
This is The Gently Mad, a show where I talk to and pick the brains of the smartest people running creative online businesses. Actually, not so much. If you're looking for that inspirational kick in the pants to help take your life and career to the next level, then this is probably not the place for you. To be perfectly honest, this podcast is about me. Hey, I'm Adam Clark, and I'm your host. Thanks for listening. I do talk to people on this show, but instead of that double rainbow of success BS that you'll get in most entrepreneurial shows, we talk about failure, self-doubt, and all the insecurities that we all have that keep us from doing much of anything with our lives. If that sounds like your kind of thing, then head over to avclark.com/TGM and subscribe. Any actionable advice or helpful tips are simply a byproduct and purely unintentional. What's up, my friends? Welcome to The Gently Mad. I'm Adam Clark. It's episode 56. I'm coming to you from the diseased headquarters of The Gently Mad in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I say diseased. There's my phone. You know, one of these days, I'm going to become professional enough at this that I remember to turn my damn iPhone off before recording. One day. We'll see. I don't even remember what I was saying. Diseased. That's what I was saying. Yeah, diseased. It has been non-stop sickness for weeks, and it's killing me. Seriously, it's killing me. All right? And this is what happens when you have kids. They get it from their little school friends and bring it home, and then my wife gets it, and then I get it, and then they get it again. And it just goes through a loop like this for what seems like an eternity, okay? Now, maybe I'm complaining about something that's not that bad. Things could be worse. Yes, that is true. We're not living out on the street. Yeah, so it's not that bad, right? But it's still pretty freaking annoying, all right? I'm tired of being sick, and it's been raining for what seems like an eternity as well. Okay, enough complaining. All right, no more complaint. That's it. I just needed to get that out. I need to get out the fact that I'm sick of being sick, and I'm sick of it raining. But today it's actually Monday. It's a beautiful day so far. Sunshine finally feels like maybe things are taking a turn for the better, and maybe this next round of sickness won't be quite as bad. That's what I'm hoping for. I've got Dan Hasseltine on the show today. Dan is one of the founding members and the lead singer and, percussionist, all sorts of instruments he plays for the band Jars of Clay. I don't know if you know Jars of Clay or not. They are a band that I've been a big fan of for, man, it's been almost 20 years now. It's been a little over 20 years since their first album came out in the 90s, but I don't remember when exactly I discovered them, mid to late 90s or so. I think it was when their second album came out, Much Afraid. And yeah, I've loved it. And as I talk to you, well, as you'll hear in the conversation with Dan, one of the things I love about Jars of Clay is that they, you know, they have consistently put out records from the beginning. Every couple of years, they've got a new album coming out, just almost like clockwork. Regular release schedule, and it's always good, and it's always different. I mean, no two albums sound alike. It's almost like they reinvent themselves with each album and evolve their sound, and they manage to pull it off to make it good. A lot of bands just can't do that. A lot of bands just, they have one thing they can do, and that's it. And I love some of those bands. You know, for example, Counting Crows. Counting Crows, which I mentioned in the show with Dan. We talked about a lot of different bands that we like and everything. And I mentioned Counting Crows. They're one of my favorite bands. But, you know, Adam Duritz is kind of a one-note kind of guy. He does one thing really well, but not much else than that. And that's okay. And I love that. And there are bands who try to reinvent themselves and try to go into a new direction, a different sound, and it just doesn't work. But with these guys, that's one of the biggest things that has amazed me about them, is just their consistent ability to evolve their sound with every album, and it'd be good. And I guess one of the things I love also about Dan in particular is his, what we got talking about, what makes good music. And because I have extremely wide tastes in music. I used to not have as wide of taste as I do. Back in the 90s, back in the day, there was a couple of styles of music I liked. The rest I didn't like, and I would tend to write off. Like most things, I've gone through various snobbery phases with music, but I've reached a point now where there's really not a kind of music that I don't like. I like all of it. I have a very wide spectrum of music that I like, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the style. It has to do with, for me, just the connection. And I've never been able to exactly put into words. I always called it the writing. But what Dan said at one point in our conversation I really liked is he talked about how what makes him like an artist is whether or not he believes them. If they can be on stage, or he can hear it, and he can hear them perform a song or sing the song, and he can believe it, he can believe them, and he can tell that it's not fake, it's not, you know, just something done for money or for whatever, but that it's really coming from the heart, as it were, as cheesy as that sounds. That's what makes it for him. And it's kind of the same thing for me too. That's what I've been trying to say in the past and haven't been able to put quite into words. So I'm really glad to have this, be able to release this conversation with Dan finally. We recorded this almost a year ago. It was last fall. I guess it hasn't been almost a year, but it was late summer, early fall 2014. And it was one of the interviews that I did in person in Nashville. I live close to Nashville. And so for a while there, I don't know, probably about 3 or 4 months, I was going to Nashville on a regular basis and recording live interviews with people. And it was something I'd never done. You know, most of these types of interviews are done over Skype, and that's fine. But I wanted to try in-person interviews. And so I admit, you know, I really did not have any idea what I was doing. So the sound quality isn't quite as great as I would like, as much as it would be if I knew then what I know now. But it was fun to get to do this stuff in person and to get to walk into their studio and look at these rooms where they've recorded albums for 20 years and sit down in those chairs and hear the stories of this thing or that thing, or point to that guitar and he would have a story for that or whatever. That was a pretty awesome thing, and I really enjoyed getting to do that. So yeah, you've heard already some of the other interviews that I've done with people in person in Nashville. Derek Webb, and who else did I talk to in person? Talked to Over the Rhine, great band in person in Nashville, and one of my favorite authors, Donald Miller, in Nashville. I think all of those episodes have been released up to this point. Dan is, I think, the last one of the bunch that I did in person to be released. And if you're not familiar with him or with Jars of Clay, just Google him. Check him out. You can go to the show notes for this episode, which will be at avclark.com/56. And all the links that we mention and talk about will be there. There's not even any way to get into Jars of Clay's catalog. Like I said, they've been together for 20 years now and have at least a dozen albums out. And then Dan himself has done some other projects. The Hawk in Paris is one of his newest projects. In fact, they just released a new song last month, I think, for that band, and it's great. And The Hawk in Paris is its own separate thing, and we get into that a little bit too. But anyway, I hope you enjoy this. A little bit different than our typical entrepreneurial focused conversation, but no less good, that's for sure. I love talking to musicians and writers and artists like this who just have a real heart for art and are able to, well, for one thing, are able to express that through music or lyrics. And for another thing, are able to, they've figured out how to do that and make money from their art, because the first one's hard enough. It's hard enough to be able to express yourself in a 3-minute pop song and make it meaningful. And then it's even harder to have enough business smarts to sell that and to make a career out of it, especially with the way the music industry is these days. So if you want to find out more, you can Google Dan Hasseltine or Jars of Clay or The Hawk in Paris. Again, all those links will be there. And we'll get to that conversation in just a minute. A couple updates on what's going on. The new show is definitely happening. And I want to say thank you to all of you who have gone to avclark.com/ask and left your podcasting questions. That show is going to be something different than I've ever done before. A daily, 7-day-a-week show, Q&A format about podcasting to go along with my podcasting course that is finally going to be opening up to the public for sale next week. So I'm excited about that stuff. If you are into podcasting and have questions and want to have your question featured on the show, go to avclark.com/ask and leave your question. And I will be in touch with you. If your question makes it onto the show, then you'll be entered to win some pretty cool gear that I'm going to be giving away as part of the launch. So go do that if you're interested in that. Much appreciated. All right, let's get to this conversation with Dan. I'll be right back after this brief word from our sponsor. The Jelly Mat is sponsored today by Harvest. And one of my favorite things about Harvest is the simplicity, the ease of use. I've said it many times, but I would give up pretty much every piece of software that I subscribe to before I would give up Harvest, because I depend on it to invoice my clients and to generate reports and track time and do all that sort of stuff. And it does it so well, and I love it. I talked to Kalina, who is a Harvest expert, meaning she interacts with a lot of customers at Harvest. And I asked her what is the craziest request they've ever received from a customer.
You know how Harvest occasionally, well, always shows you a quote in an empty time entry?
Yeah.
So we just had a long list of really strange quotes that somebody wanted to add. It was just like a bunch of quotes. I wish I could pull it up for you, because some of those quotes are pretty crazy. It was just like, work until you drink and then drink until you fall down. The strangest one was when someone requested that we become a password manager, like 1Password or LastPass or something like that.
What was the logic behind that? Like, why would they, do you know?
We have a Chrome extension. So I think they had been using the Chrome extension, and they're like, oh, this is great. I can access Harvest from my Chrome menu bar. And then they also had a LastPass Chrome extension. And so they must have thought, if you're a Chrome extension, you can do a lot of things.
Yeah. Okay, so if you're trying to keep track of your passwords, maybe Harvest is not your best option. But I think that's a good thing, because what Harvest does do, it does extremely well. And I've already mentioned what it does so well for me. And I encourage you to check them out. It's getharvest.com. You can sign up there, and your first month is already free. And you can get 50% off your second month by using the promo code TGM at checkout. Again, that's getharvest.com. And the promo code is TGM. Thanks to Harvest for sponsoring the Gently Mat. All right, folks, I do hope you check that out. Harvest is awesome. I love them. And that is a great deal they have going. So be sure and check that out. let's get to this conversation. It was a really good one. I enjoyed it. You'll hear some conversation going on in the background. Different people were kind of walking in and out of the studio while we were recording this. People that had, you know, a lot to do with the history of Jars of Clay and with Dan Hasseltine himself. They would have made great conversations in and of themselves. But I hope you enjoy this one, and I'll be back at the end to wrap things up. So you were saying this is the new Sputnik Studios where...
Yeah, this is the new Sputnik Studio where we're in right now. And it's had a few different iterations. It started out in our guitar player's basement. That was the first version of Sputnik. And we recorded 11th Hour down there. We recorded Who We Are Instead. We recorded a lot of Redemption songs in that space too, and then it moved out of the basement to a house down the street from here, which is now the House of Blues Studios spaces. There's a whole bunch of those around in this one little block in the neighborhood, and one of those houses was Sputnik, and we recorded our Christmas record, and we recorded the rest of Redemption songs and Long Fall Back to Earth there, and did some overdubbing for Good Monsters there. And then after that, we bought our own studio space just down the road from there.
Yeah.
Which you were able to see briefly.
Yeah.
Which is our Brown Recluse Refuge, we like to call it. just the warehouse building, which is also known as Gray Matter Studio, which is kind of our imprint label. But right now, this is the new Sputnik, because this is where Vance Powell and Mitch Dane, two guys that were, you know, with us for all those years recording those records with us. Now this is their space, which is a brilliant studio, and I'm fairly jealous that that they have such a nice place. Yeah.
So this part of town, like I said, I'm not super familiar with the Nashville geography. The most I know is I've been in town a few times playing shows right downtown, like near where the Hard Rock is and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah.
But so where we are right now, are there a lot of music studios over here?
Yeah, this is the Berry Hill area, and this is kind of where Music Row somewhat migrated to. A little bit further south of town. It's almost all the houses in the area at one point have been studios.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's open development area.
Yeah.
And so there aren't many restrictions on the kinds of places you can build or what you can do with the space or a property. So it's a pretty eclectic area.
Yeah.
But it's also a great space for studios though.
Cool.
And, you know, as few and far between as they are these days, because everyone can record a record in their house.
Yeah.
This is sort of still a great place to come if you need a studio space and you want to work in a place that has more of an aesthetic and you can record great drum sounds and strings and things like that.
Yeah.
This is fantastic.
You know, it is true. Like, it's 2014. The last 15 years, I guess, have, you can throw up some Orlex in a room and you've got Pro Tools and an iMac and... you can make a stellar record just by yourself. I mean, what's the appeal? Is it just the historicity of it? Is it just the feeling like how many other great artists have been in this room that you're in that makes you, makes these studios still viable? You know, that's a weird question, I guess. Why do people still come to do them in studios like this?
Yeah. You know? It's hard to say. I mean, I know why I do that.
Yeah.
For me, there is an element of that history involved. There's an element of being in a space where people have risen to the challenge of making great records.
Yeah.
And I think that makes me better.
Yeah.
When I'm in the space, I feel that, and it makes me want to spend more time on a part or sing better, or, you know, there's a certain level or standard that you set for yourself that's different in this space. And I don't really know what that is other than it's just certain places have influence.
Yeah.
that's why cities have certain sounds.
Yeah.
You know, you can kind of tell the kind of music that comes out of one city that doesn't in another.
Yeah.
It's based on the history, the geography, all of it kind of plays in. And then, and I think that's true on a smaller scale of individual studios. You go into a certain space, it has a certain aesthetic, and that'll come out in the songs.
Yeah. That's awesome. I didn't say at the beginning, but obviously, I'm here with Dan Hasseltine at Sputnik Studios. It's Hasseltine, right?
It's Hasseltine.
Hasseltine. I always wondered.
It's been a lot of different things. I mean, when I was in junior high, it was Ovaltine.
Ovaltine?
And Has No Friends. That was the other one. So, you know, junior high is always brutal.
Right.
But, so I pretty much, you know, it's whatever anybody says.
It's whatever people say.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the official is Hasseltine.
Hasseltine.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
Are you from, where are you from?
I'm from Massachusetts originally, was born and spent the first 15 years of my life up in New England, in Connecticut and Massachusetts both, and then migrated to Orlando, Florida for high school and then came to Nashville after college where I spent about 2 years in Illinois.
Yeah.
So now I've been in Nashville for a little over 20 years now, it's home.
So definitely.
And you know, really in the last 5 years, I would say home that I'm really proud of. You know, in the music industry, a lot of times when you're going out to LA or going to New York, you used to somewhat have to apologize when you said you were from Nashville.
Yeah.
And now you don't have to do that anymore. Now
you
kind of can say, I'm from Nashville, and you can hold your head high and say, this is where all the good music's coming out of these days.
Yeah.
So
nice.
Suck it, LA and New York. Yeah.
Do you still have family back in Massachusetts?
I do. I have just some extended family up there. Most of them have migrated to the South though. They've gone down to Florida and
what caused the Florida move?
Winter.
Oh.
Pretty much it was winter. It was family saying we're done with winter for 8 months out of the year, and just the cold and the snow, and so they moved down where they don't get that anymore.
Are they still down there?
They are, and enjoying winter so much more. Although I miss New England in the fall. That's the time of year that still, even being away from it for close to 30 years, I'm still like, I still miss it.
My dad was from New Brunswick, you know, which is a bit farther north than that. But so we spent a good bit of time in the northeast and parts of New England. And I always thought I would end up there someday. It hasn't happened yet, but you never know. It is great for the weather. But so what, you know, you obviously have a long history in the music industry. I mean, you've made it. I mean, you are a working musician. You guys have put out so many albums and, not to say that it's been easy or anything, but like, how did the whole thing start? I mean, were you in a very musical family? When did you think I want to be a musician?
Yeah, I guess you know, the more I've thought about it, I used to say that, no, I didn't have a terribly musical family. That was probably just because I blocked out a lot of my childhood early on and, you know, was trying to think forward. But, the more I've sort of reconnected with family and thought about the past, as I've gotten older, I realized that I did grow up around music. My family, nobody really played professionally or did anything like that, but they always had records on.
Yeah.
You know, from the time I was little, my parents, you know, they had one of those great console record players with the 8-track player next to it. And so we would put on records, and it was ABBA or The Who or Queen. And those were the records that kind of introduced me to rock and roll music and pop music. And my brother is a guitar player. He started playing guitar, and I started picking songs off the radio on a keyboard when I was about 6 years old. And my parents finally bought me a piano, and, you know, and I wrestled through piano lessons for a little while.
Yeah.
You know, so I really did grow up in it, and I guess for me, I found that music was a great way to sort of combat some of the social awkwardness I felt like I had.
Yeah.
I was not good at making friends when I was little.
Yeah.
You know, I was very much an introvert. And also I internalized everything. So, yeah. So I would see what was happening around me or in my family, or when things would be, there was turmoil or anything like that, I would go up to my room and I would play music, play piano. And so, music was always the thing I leaned on all through that. It was what I used to try to get dates in junior high and high school. And, you know, but I was somewhat of a nerd then. My first band was, it was four keyboard players.
Nice.
Yeah. And we were doing new wave music. It was back in the '80s. And
yeah.
And so we were playing Depeche Mode and New Order covers and just sitting in a room. We never played out.
Yeah.
It was always just being in. So.
And I totally identify with that. I mean, I did the same thing. I would, when I was a teenager, my jobs as a 15-year-old, 16-year-old, I would come home at night and piano was the way to de-stress, and to deal with things. Mm-hmm. And so I get that. But you were talking about how, you were also using it to try to, get dates. And your first band. What was the name of that, by the way? The four keyboard band.
We didn't really have a name. We didn't need one because we would never play out. So we didn't really call ourselves anything. But it was, but to us, we were a band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My first band, we had a name, we had t-shirts, we had album art, but we didn't have any songs.
Yeah, which is great. I mean, I think that
we had all the ancillary things in place, but we just needed some songs.
Yeah.
So
there are a lot of bands like that though these days that have great t-shirts, great album artwork, a great sort of caricature of themselves, and then no music.
Yeah.
So that seems to be...
Or the music itself isn't that great.
Terrible.
So,
yeah. Second rate.
Yeah. So you're doing that. That was... this was high school time frame?
That was junior high and high school. Yeah. And then in high school, I played in a lot of different bands. And that was when I decided. I was like, okay, I think I want music to be a part of my career on some level. So...
Yeah.
So then I went to college to study music. And
where'd you go to school?
I went to Greenville College, which is just a really small school in Southern Illinois.
Okay.
And I don't really know how I ended up there, but that's where I met the other guys in Jars.
Mm-hmm.
We were all there. And I think something about the music program was a bit unique for the time.
Yeah.
Back in the early 90s, there weren't many schools. Like now you've got Belmont University and a lot of these music programs are doing more in commercial music and pop music. But if you wanted to go to school to study music, even back in the 90s, then you had to sort of focus more on jazz or classical. It was still more of a, it wasn't much of a pop music kind of education. So, so this school had a bent that was a little more commercial music oriented. Mm. And I think that appealed to us. And so we ended up there. And that school, it oddly enough, has been like a great incubator for a lot of different creative collaborations. I mean, a lot of bands have come out of there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, we were kind of making a list not too long ago. We're like, wow, a lot of groups have formed at Greenville and then left. You know, they haven't ever finished their degree there, but they've...
Well,
but
like,
it's been a good space. The band Augustana.
Yeah.
Remember them? Mm-hmm. Dan Leas, I think, was the leader. He was there. Paper Route was another band that formed.
I love Paper
out of
Route.
There. Yeah. Yeah, great. And then, obviously, Jars. There was a girl named Sarah John that was there for a while and started doing music. And it's just... It's been a great kind of creative incubator for a lot of really
crazy.
Great musicians.
I would not have known that you and Augustana and Paper Route were connected in that way.
Yeah. So it's pretty exciting to see. It's fun to see it now. Like see how they've developed and how these artists have grown and become what they are. Because there was a spark that started there somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when did you, I mean, when was the point where you thought I can... do this for a living? You know, did you have a backup? Were you headed down, to be a doctor or something and then changed your mind? I mean,
I think I wanted to do music. I didn't know what it would look like.
Yeah.
I obviously had it in my head that I would be playing in an arena in front of thousands and thousands of people. That was the goal back then, right? So Yeah, I don't know that I knew what it
but
looked
so you
like,
actually
but there was
went
a point.
To school like thinking, I want to be in a band.
Yeah.
I want to be a working musician.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I, you know, I wouldn't have known how to do that, how to get there. I didn't really know anything about the music industry.
Yeah.
So.
Were your parents like supportive of that or
yeah.
more like, you know, you need to get a real job kind of thing or?
They were really supportive actually. And I think in the way that they were just like, well, he's going to figure it out.
You yeah.
know, something's going to come up or he's going to do something different.
And, yeah.
But what was interesting was there was a point where I had to make the choice. When Jars was first getting started, I mean, I spent the remaining money that I had for tuition to go back to school for my junior year.
Yeah.
I spent on producing or on manufacturing the Jars of Clay record. So at that point, wow. I was like, I'm making a choice to not come yeah. back to college. And I'm really hoping that this works out because
yeah.
I'm all in. And it worked out, which is a great thing.
Was that a tough decision for you? I mean, like, did you kind of agonize over that or did you just know I'm just doing this?
At the time, I was pretty confident.
Yeah.
I was pretty sure that what we were doing was unique
yeah.
and was worth pursuing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And we had, cool. you know, a lot of people around us were doing really great cheerleading for us. You know, people,
really?
You know, the school was really supportive. Our professors were very supportive. You know, everyone was kind of going, yeah, you know what, give it a shot.
So by the time you recorded that first album, had you been playing shows and building up kind of like a fan base or did anyone know who you were at that point?
No, not off campus. I mean, we played on campus in a coffee shop setting, like once a month.
Yeah.
And would do like one or two songs.
Mm-hmm.
We would always sort of test out a new song that we had written.
Yeah.
And that was how we sort of figured out if a song seemed good or not.
Yeah.
Was how our classmates reacted to it.
Yeah.
And then we went down to Nashville our midway through our sophomore year, and that's how we won a Battle of the Bands competition
okay.
there. And that is what gave us some label attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went back to school. That was during spring break. And we went back to school to finish out that year and started getting phone calls from record labels.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when we kind of all sat and thought, all right, this is something we should take seriously. Let's.
And this was like what, like 1993.
Yeah. And then, so we left that year, went down to Nashville that summer and said, well, we'll come back if nothing happens.
Yeah.
But we signed a contract that year and just kind of headed out on the road to start playing shows.
So you signed with the label then. I mean,
yeah.
did that mean, what did that mean then? Did that mean, here's money to live on for the year? Was there salary?
No.
What was involved for
no,
you?
No, we were living in a two-bedroom apartment at the time. And all of us were, you know, four of us in a two-bedroom apartment in not a great part of Nashville. And we were working remodeling an office supply store at night. So we would work from 9 at night until 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah.
and that was kind of our job. And then we'd get up around noon and then go work on music for a little while and then
yeah.
go to sleep for a little bit longer and then get up and go to work again. And that's what we did for a little season. And then we were able to kind of get a little bit of money under for an advance, not much. And
mm-hmm.
and then we went and recorded. And then we went on tour probably a month after we finished the record. It was
yeah.
really quick.
How long was it before you were able to stop the side jobs? You know, you're able to live off of your art.
When we left to go on tour, we left at that point. So that from the time frame of leaving college, it was probably about 6 months before
yeah.
we stopped working anywhere. And we just went out on the road
yeah.
and just hoped that we would make enough out there to support what we needed. And we were, you know, single guys, college age, driving in a minivan.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have very many expenses and we didn't need
yeah.
very much. And so, you know, so it didn't take much to cover our living expenses. We were eating ramen noodles and like boxes of cereal. So it wasn't like we were having to cover very much, but it was exciting. When we left, we didn't come back. Like, we went on tour with PFR. This band let us open for them, and we did two tours in a row with them, and then got off the road with them and jumped on tour with Michael W. Smith.
Yeah.
And when Michael W. Smith had us out opening for him was the time when Flood started gaining momentum on radio. Mm. And so we started doing a show for Michael W. Smith. And then we would get in a van after opening for him and drive into whatever city we were in and play some seedy bar or club for the local rock radio station.
Yeah.
Because Flood was hitting there too. And so, and that just, we were out on the road for, you know, we did 300 dates that first year.
Yeah.
So we didn't come home for a year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's really interesting, I feel like you guys were the first, like Christian music was different before Jars of Clay than after Jars of Clay, you know? I mean, I feel like, you know, you guys, before you guys, you know, Christian music had a very, you know, it had a certain feel. It didn't feel like regular music, you know? It didn't feel like regular bands. I mean, you had your band, you had your Stripers, and you had your one, you know, but I mean, most Christian music had its own distinct, you know, you mentioned Michael W. Smith and people like that and Sandy Patty and Twilight Paris and all that stuff. And you guys come along and suddenly you're like a pop rock band, you know, and you have the same, you know, sound. How did that even, what made you think we can do what everyone else is doing, but just with our own, you know, put our faith in it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I think we would have said we stumbled into it.
Yeah.
I mean, we weren't, there was no master plan, you know, in terms of that. We were just writing music that inspired us.
Yeah.
Based off of the music we listened to.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were developing our sound during kind of what they call post-grunge.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of, you know, we spent a lot of time listening to grunge music, and it was Pearl Jam and Stone Temple Pilots and, you know, Alice in Chains and all these bands like that that were big. And then also the techno scene was really big in St. Louis at the time.
Yeah.
And so we were listening to a lot of breakbeat music. And then a few of us still had kind of this acoustic side of folk music that we loved, the Indigo Girls and James Taylor and artists like that. And so we were, you know, our influences just sort of converged in a way that made sense. And, you know, who would have known that putting all those elements together would have actually sounded good, but it did.
Well, it's interesting that I guess what I'm trying to say is I feel like in a way you guys kind of launched or helped launch what became known as CCM, you know, and now you're not really in that anymore. But, you know, that whole decade of Christian artists that started, you know, coming out, I feel like, I don't know, around the mid-90s when you guys released your first album, and then Much Afraid was the second one, is that right?
Yeah.
And those two albums, I mean, it seemed like then suddenly there were then more, it just seemed like it partly launched that whole CCM thing. Do you think that? Do you feel that way? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think we recognized that when we came out, that it sort of represented a shift in the musical environment.
Yeah.
And which is great. And I think what we loved about it, and what we would like to take credit for, I don't know that we can, but is that artists had permission to be creative.
Yeah.
You know, to let, you know, there was always that saying like, well, the message has to be more important than the medium.
Yeah.
And people would argue that all the time with us, and we would say, well, you have to be excellent at both.
Yeah.
You have to be innovative and creative, and you've got to find words that makes, you know, that are better than the throwaway words that a lot of people use in the church.
And,
you know, so we would always challenge people on that, and always kind of say, well, write something better, and don't always feel like you have to use the same words everyone else has used. Be prophetic. Just talk about what's real.
Yeah.
What's human. And I think that was the part that we wanted to usher in. And I felt like for a few years, there was this kind of surge of artists, you know, it's like Sixpence, although they were around before us,
right,
where they sort of really kind of pushed that envelope a lot, that the record, This Beautiful Mess, and mm-hmm. some of that stuff before they kind of, before Kiss Me, and those records, like they were really tapping into something really interesting and yeah. innovative, and Switchfoot obviously coming into the picture early on, and
yeah.
you know, John was really innovative back then, and
yeah, I guess I feel like John Foreman and Lee Nash and those people yeah. were I don't know, I feel like they didn't quite identify quite as much with the, like they weren't as overtly, you know,
right.
if you want to call it Christian, or as overtly, you know, in their lyrics and their songwriting as you guys were,
yeah.
At least in the beginning.
Right.
And so like when I was listening to them, I wasn't necessarily thinking, you know, oh, these guys are Christians or this is a Christian band. But mm-hmm. when I listened to Jars of Clay, I mean, it's very clear that it was, you know?
Yeah.
And what made you, I mean, if you're listening to Alice in Chains and Nirvana and, what did you mention? Stone Temple Pilots or,
yeah.
You know, the bands that you mentioned, what made you start a, you know, a band where you wrote about your faith and Christian topics, you know, a Christian band at that time
yeah.
versus just, we're just starting a regular old band, you know, and we're going to talk about what everyone else is talking about.
Well, I think part of it was what I had grown up in.
Yeah.
I kind of grew up in the church and, you know, I was part of the youth group culture. And,
yeah.
And so that was, you know, Bruce Springsteen, you know, Write What You Know.
Yeah.
And so that was the world that I knew. And so the songs would come out that way.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and a lot of people would look at the Jars sort of spiritual content trajectory and go, wow, they've really, like, it shifted a lot over the years. And I think that was just us moving from a space of, you know, being young kids and having a very kind of simple idea of what faith was like,
mm-hmm.
and then living a little bit.
Yeah.
Seeing the world, butting up against other cultures and other ideas, and realizing that the things that we thought were so simple and easy really weren't.
Yeah.
And so our questions became deeper.
Yeah, there's definitely, yeah. like, you compare, you know, your last album.
Yeah.
Which was great, from last year. You compare it to the first album.
Oh, yeah.
And just content-wise, it's completely,
yeah.
it's completely different, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like you guys have taken more of, like, the, I was going to say the Switchfoot route, not that that's a route, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like where it's like you guys have your faith and you're Christians and everything, but... it's not necessarily that your music is about that anymore.
Yeah. Well, and we hit a point, I think, in our career where we decided, you know, we're sort of done trying to explain our faith.
Yeah.
People were, you know, we were kind of tired of some of the ways that, I mean, we were using, trying to be as innovative as anybody else in the music world.
Yeah.
We were working with the best producers, working with the best engineers, writing with great songwriters, and really, you know, pouring ourselves into these records. And then we would watch the reviews come in, and not that reviews matter
yeah.
per se, but the critics would spend, you know, you get what, 6 lines to write a review in a magazine, and 5 of those lines would be spent on them making some clever jab about religion.
Yeah.
And they would never talk about our music, and then we would get dismissed, and
right.
and I think that we took that pretty hard at different points, and just realized, you know what, there's something about the cultural conversation that either we're not getting or they're not getting.
Yeah.
And so it forced us to kind of keep changing every record and kind of go, okay,
yeah.
well, how do we change the language, or what are we doing? What are the blind spots that we have in what we're trying to communicate that are making people not care about our music because they think it's Christian in a way,
yeah.
you know?
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's like, it's because people, I think, tend to, everything is classified, you know, everything
yeah.
has a classification, and Christian music is its own little world,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that's changed a lot in the last 10 years with bands like you guys and Switchfoot and Derek Webb and things that, you know, you guys have been doing. But still, there's this, you know, it's like if it's got a faith element to the content, then it's relegated to like a sub niche, a subcategory of art, and it's judged on different terms, you know. Yeah. And anyway, so yeah, that wasn't really a question, but you guys decided, you know, we don't want to be, you know, pigeonholed in here anymore.
Yeah, we want to be part of the. We feel like we are a part of the broader cultural conversation, mm-hmm. and so we want our music to reflect that, and we want the potential for us to have our music presented to reflect that also. Yeah. And there was, I remember a lot of artists complaining because, like, when you'd go into a record shop, and there are very few anymore, but you would see that the Christian music section was always right next to the comedy section in a record shop, and you're like, okay, it's what like are the least viable kind of relevant kind of musical sections are over way over here in this corner with the dust on them. And I was like, well, that's not what we're striving for. And I can see how in a music store, if you've got a bunch of artists in a genre that don't care about the music and only care about the message that they're trying to spread or have an agenda, that it's not relevant in the music world because they're not making good music.
Yeah.
But we felt like we were, and we felt like we wanted to be represented better than that. So
do you feel like that has changed at all? Like, is it easier to be a Christian and be a musician and not have to be a Christian band? Does that make sense today than it used to be?
I think there's a generational aspect that's at work in that. And so... Yes, I think on one level there is the potential to be able to kind of find those lines blurred.
Yeah.
And I think our generation and the generation coming up behind us, they know that, you know, that truth is not exclusive to Christian artists. And in fact, I think they're seeing that there's a lot of artists out there that wouldn't proclaim to be Christian artists that are saying some things that resonate deeply with people, and as it should be, you know. Yeah. I think we're recognizing that we all live on this earth, we're all part of this world, and we all have this human experience.
Yeah.
And there's so much relatable things, you know, so many relatable things that happen, the way we, you know, we break each other's hearts and the way we recover from hard things.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of that stuff is worth talking about. And when somebody who's not a Christian, who doesn't know sort of Christian terms or language, is wrestling with something loftier than just being human, it's a really great and intimate and vulnerable expression usually.
Yeah.
And I love those. And so it's what made me even gravitate. I don't listen to a lot of Christian music because I find that I want those more honest expressions.
Yeah.
And I want to hear the human story in it.
Well, that's so, like, I don't even think of it in those terms anymore. Like for it's almost like there are artists and bands and writers and musicians that I like and those that I don't, you know?
Yeah.
And some of them happen to be Christians and some of them happen to not be. And some of them write worship songs and some of them don't. It's like, I don't know. I feel like for me personally, I've just lost that divide isn't there anymore, you know?
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's just me, or like you said, if like maybe a younger generation that didn't come out of like the 70s and the 80s and the, I'm totally blank, Keith Green era, you know, that didn't come out of that are, you know, just don't see that divide either anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, my criteria for a lot of that, I gravitate towards things I believe.
Yeah.
Like I hear an artist sing something and I, you know, do I believe them?
Yeah.
Or you know, when they sing this, when they, you know, deliver a line, do I care?
Yeah.
And do I really think that's them? And if I do, then I'm usually in for the ride at that point, and I'll go along.
Yeah.
But if I kind of hear someone being fake or I think they're kind of lying to me, you know, I'll dismiss it. I'll throw it away.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, going back, you had the first record, you started touring. I mean, when did you have the realization, like, I don't know whether it was when Much Afraid came out or whatever, or what, but, and I may be remembering history wrong, but I feel like Much Afraid was that a much bigger record for you guys in terms of popularity?
Yeah.
Than the first one?
Yeah, it's interesting. It was a much, yeah, I mean, we had more opportunities in the context of that record, as a young band. I mean, we'd learned how to play our instruments. We wanted to be a band after that. The first record was all programmed and all kind of sample loops and stuff like that with some drum overdubs. And
I mean, I've been a long time fan, but obviously, knowing that I was going to be talking to you, I went back and listened through most of the catalog, and it struck me, how different of a sound you guys had between the first and second record.
Yeah.
And it also strikes me that you guys, I've always thought that you change your sound so often. Like, you never know. I never knew what to expect when a new album would come out, because it would be, you know, one is like super country and acoustic, and the next one's all electronic, and then the next one's just straight up pop, and then the next one's like, I never knew what to expect. But it was amazing to me listening to the first and two records back to back a couple weeks ago. It almost sounds like a different band, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's there.
Well, we were.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, to think of all that we had gone through, and I mean, it was 3 years between those records.
Yeah.
And so a lot of life happens in 3 years.
Yeah.
And for us,
especially at that age.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. A lot of experiences. We were, you know, we had started dating girls and we're all getting married. And, you know, there was, life was really happening quickly.
Yeah.
And, in the span of that second record, like, I went through a major depression getting off the road after that first album. It was sort of life catching back up. I tend to think that Much Afraid was sort of our growing up album. Mm-hmm. And it's when we decided intentionally to be a band and to make a record that would be classic, that would hopefully stand the test of time, that wouldn't just be kind of trendy sounding or just sort of cash in on all the,
well, it does,
the sounds, I mean, of the time.
I thought that listening to it, I was like, you know, to me, the first record definitely sounds like a mid-90s record, you know, but Much Afraid to me even now still sounds like this could have come out now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And that's what we were trying to make. And I mean, we had a great, great producer on that record with us, Stephen Lipson, who, you know, I was somewhat enamored with because he had worked on a lot of the Simple Minds records from the 80s, and I was a huge fan. So, so that was exciting to work with him. And, he brought in some really amazing folks to work with us on that record.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of writing for that record that, you know, Steve Mason, our guitar player, and I went and spent some time in France at a castle out there writing with a lot of different folks, and connected with Greg Wells, who now people might know Greg Wells' name because he produced a lot of stuff for Katy Perry and wrote along with Adele on her records. And
okay.
He's sort of a powerhouse songwriter producer. And the other guy was a guy named Mark Hudson, mm-hmm. who has written a lot of great songs, was part of Ringo Starr's All-Star Band, and wrote a lot of songs with Aerosmith. And it was just these guys that were, you know, definitely pushing us to be better songwriters.
Yeah.
And so we brought that influence into that record. You know, we were growing up, we were learning how to be serious musicians and at the same time just trying to make sense of everything that happened.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't really make sense of it until, it's funny, there are seasons where we would think it took us almost a decade to just catch up to where we had been and what we had done.
Yeah.
As a band. And you know, Jars is a band that's we never stop. We're always in the process of making a new project or doing something creative.
Well, by the time the second one came out, by that time, had you realized this is going to work? You know, we're going to be able to live off this, and this is what we're going to do, you know?
Not really. I wish we had because I think we would have had more fun. Mm-hmm. But back then, you know, the 90s were an interesting time in the music industry. There's a lot of money getting thrown around in the 90s, but everything was high stakes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our manager would bring us an opportunity and he would say, you know, if you guys don't do this, your career is over. or if you do this, your career is over.
That's how I approach every decision.
And everything was sort of, it seemed like it was always teetering on, oh my gosh, we could make one mistake and everything could just go away. And that's a scary place to be, and it's not any fun. And so we were miserable a lot of the time for those first few records. And it wasn't until
When do you think that changed?
I think we needed the brakes to kind of come on. And it was good. After the third record, we took a year off. Mm-hmm. And we just wrote songs and sat in the studio. And I went and worked on a movie soundtrack. And it was sort of a year to be at home. I had my first child that year. And it was just like, it was the exhale.
Yeah.
And the first time we had a chance to do it. And so it had been about almost a decade.
Yeah.
Since we left home, went on tour, and then thing just got shot out of a cannon and couldn't catch up.
Yeah.
And we're just reacting to everything that came our way. And then that was the year where we sort of tried to pick up some of the pieces and slow everything down and find ourselves working at a pace that had some quality of life attached to it, so we weren't killing ourselves. I don't know that we ever actually got there until Much Afraid. I mean, until Good Monsters. Mm. Good Monsters was the record where I feel like we actually started making decisions about what we wanted to be doing as a band ourselves. Well,
that was like 10 years in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Easily.
So all this time, you know, you guys have just been, you know, every couple of years, sometimes less than that, you know, you put out a new album, you know. You are doing a new thing now with the Hawk in Paris, and I'm sure maybe you've done some other side things in the past, but you know, where's Jars going? Is it just, you know, you guys are one of the few bands that I feel like just consistently album after album is good stuff, you know, which I feel like that's really rare, because you know, with most bands, you know, you're hit or miss sometimes. It's like, well, that album wasn't the greatest. We didn't really like that one. But you know, even like Counting Crows, which is probably one of my all-time favorite bands, they've put out some stuff that I'm just like, you know, that's pretty terrible. You know, I just, you know, don't like that at all. But you guys, especially going back and listening through the catalog, I'm like, just one after the other after that, I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that one. Oh, yeah, I remember that one. And it's like, they're all just consistently good. Like,
thank you for that.
And that's not, I'm not just saying, it's not right. just flattery. I'm just saying, you know, it's like that's an amazing feat.
Yeah.
You know,
we're all, I don't know. I mean, it's hard. I don't know what it is other than to say, like, we've tried to figure it out at different points. We've wrestled with, like, what ghosts are we running away from that keep us working so hard in these spaces, in the creative spaces? Because there should be seasons when, you as an artist, you just sort of sit back and rest on some of the things you've created in the past. And we've never been content to do that. Like, we've always just, I don't know if it's a competitive nature that we've felt or because of the way Jars began, there is this constant need to keep proving ourselves musically and creatively. And we still have this weird sense that we're going to be dismissed if we don't do something great.
Yeah.
Or we feel like, well, maybe we'll let our fans down if we can't keep raising the bar, we're going to lose a bunch of our fans. And some of it's fear, but I think it's none of those things really. I just think we love music.
Yeah.
And I think we're music fans. And, you know, in the band, all of us we still love that discovery element of music.
Yeah.
You know, we like to go down the rabbit hole and find bands and hear things that are happening that you're like, wow, that's new. That's startling.
Yeah.
Never heard that before. Or I love the way that they're bringing that sound back into something. Mm-hmm. And so I think because we're music fans, when we get in the studio to create music, And there's so many things that influence us that that are inspiring, and we try to bring that in with us.
Yeah, is the change in style intentional, or is it just that by the time you go to record that next record, you guys are all listening to different music at that time, and that's just what comes out of you, you know?
Yeah, it's a combination, because we think of ourselves as a songwriting band.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is that we don't feel bound to a particular style. We've elbowed our way into using a lot of different textures and stuff over the years. So I feel like we could do just about anything at this point, and our fans would be comfortable enough with it. You know, it wouldn't all sound great, but there would be space for it.
Yeah.
And you know, I think we love that part about Jars is that we can do that. You know, we can take all of the influences and bring them together. And, And so, I don't know. I mean, I think we serve the song.
Yeah.
You know, as a songwriting band, you serve the song. We're not serving the brand. We're not serving what people think we're supposed to sound like.
Yeah.
We're serving, you know, so when we write a song and it's like, oh, you know what? We could do the song with acoustics, but actually I think what would make it better is to do it more with synth or something. Mm-hmm. And we made, like when we did Long Fall Back to Earth, one of the reasons that record was so kind of synth pop heavy was actually because the content of the record was so heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was dark relational stuff.
Yeah.
And we thought, you know, if we put this record in an acoustic skin, people are going to just, it's going to destroy people. Like it's just not the kind of record you'd want to listen to. It wouldn't be enjoyable.
Yeah.
And so we felt like we had to play against the drama in the lyric and actually create music that sort of in some ways was a weird juxtaposition. So,
yeah.
So some of it's just that, we just think creatively about it and go, well,
yeah,
what's going to work best for the song, not the band.
Yeah. What do you think, this may not be something you can answer, but like, what is it that there are bands and artists like you guys who just consistently year after year, every couple of years, just consistently put out, you know, I don't know even how many albums is it now?
It depends on which ones you count.
Well, it's a lot anyway.
There's 12, I think.
You know, you know, just over your careers, like I said, just consistent, good work. And then there are some bands that, like Third Eye Blind, for example, in the last 15, 16 years, they've put out 4 albums, you know, and only 3 of them were kind of good, you know, in my opinion. You know, what is the, it's kind of a weird question, but, you know, I feel like you see, like, there are those artists who just, they put out stuff. It's like you're lucky to get something once every 5 years from them, you know, and then there are guys like you who just, it's just what you do every year, every 2 years, something new's coming out. You know, is it just a work ethic, a philosophy, or is it just, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think we love having the creative outlet.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is a gift to be able to make music and then to have a place to present it.
Yeah.
And people buy it and then we get to keep doing it. I mean, that's a gift because, I mean, you look at the, like right now, what the statistic is something like of the 75,000 records that come out every year now, 70 or 80% of those sell one copy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's like, it's staggering the kind of statistics, and that one's probably wrong, but it's close to that. I remember reading something, I was going, wow, you know what? It really puts it in perspective to go, you know, when a fan, we don't call them fans anymore. We call them patrons because they've been with us for so long. They're not writing our names in puffy paint on t-shirts anymore. These are people who are serious about their music. And so we don't like to call them fans because to me that tends to be almost a younger kind of term. But we've had a relationship with our patrons now for so long. They're in a conversation with us.
Yeah.
And it feels like a conversation, so it's always kind of ongoing.
Yeah.
And I think we feel compelled to keep the conversation going.
Yeah.
Because it's always interesting, and it always kind of takes these odd turns. And whether that's into the areas of social justice or music history or any of those sorts mm-hmm. of areas, we've been able to keep this audience and have the conversation. And so I think that's why we keep doing it.
Yeah.
And we love writing songs, and if you've got them, there's no reason not to have them available and let people hear them. That's why we do it.
Well, you've got a new, I guess it's not super new, but the Hawk and Paris is is a newer project. And I remember when you released that EP on Noise Trade a while back, and I thought it was great. And then I thought the album was never going to come out.
Yeah, I know.
Because it was a while, and then it came out last year. And so is this signaling like a change for you? Is this going to affect Jars? Is this a new direction, or is this just a side project for the time being?
It's a legitimate project. So I wouldn't say that it's completely just a side project, because it's moving mm-hmm. more into the center.
Yeah.
But it really is just a way to kind of balance out what happens with Jars too. It was, for me, it was somewhat of an experiment just to connect with Matt Bronlaway again, who wrote a lot of that first Jars record with me, and we'd written some Plum record stuff and over the years. And then Jeremy Bowes, who was another college friend, just to see what would happen. And the chemistry is really great, and we love and enjoy writing together. So I think we just see it as an opportunity to make music that we love. Mm-hmm. And right now we're sort of in a the musical landscape is adaptable, and it welcomes mm-hmm. the kind of genre that we're working in right now. And that may not always be the case, but we feel like the Hawk stuff will keep evolving, and we'll grow into something more.
Yeah.
And I think it takes pressure off of Jars. There was a season when I was really pushing hard for Jars stylistically to adopt some of my influences from the 80s. And mm-hmm. and although everyone was sort of accommodating of that and it worked, it felt like a lot of pressure on Jars, who, it doesn't have to carry the weight of all those influences coming out. And so I like having another expression that can sort of shoulder that new wave and synth pop kind of arena rock side that I love.
Yeah. Does that mean the next Jars record is gonna go back to being a acoustic folk?
Well, rock? I feel like that's where, like, Inland sort of is where it sort of came back into the center. I feel like because mm-hmm. it's we removed the long fall, like the sort of the uber synth stuff. And then,
Inland is still really poppy, though. I mean, it's still got that, definitely. It's danceable. I mean, it's radio friendly. I mean, it's still got a lot of, but I can see what you mean. It's a little bit more, it's a step back from Long Fall Back to Earth.
Definitely. Sure. Yeah. And so I think that's where things will sit. And we've been working on this Jars 20 record, and mm-hmm. that's more acoustic and more of a band sound.
Yeah.
Because we wanted people to, like, if you put headphones on, we want people to feel like they're actually in the room with us while we're making music. And so it's really tight. Vance actually mixed the record, this new one, for us. It sounds amazing. So
It's done.
It's done, yeah.
Okay.
But we have a couple new songs on there, and it sort of is a further development from Inland.
So you have a whole new record that's already done.
We have a whole new record, but old record, because it's 20 songs, two songs from each record.
Oh, okay.
That we've re-recorded, that our patrons, our fans picked.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went back in the studio and recorded these songs again, which is really a great experience.
Yeah.
I don't know that many artists that get that opportunity mm-hmm. that are around long enough to then be able to kind of go back and revisit their catalog that way.
Yeah.
And spend time with the songs outside of the economy of, I'm relying on this song to sell records, I'm relying on this song to be a pop radio single, or, mm-hmm. And all those other things that you have to deal with. When you kind of pull that all the way and you're just able to kind of look at the songs as songs
mm-hmm.
and expressions, there's something about that that's very kind of therapeutic, and you know, we were going through our history as a band and recording these songs again and going, wow, you know what? I never got to focus on what I loved about the song because I was so worried about the economy of selling records.
So have you changed them up stylistically? Or are they, you know, similar to the original versions?
Yeah, I mean, I think we just pulled, if there are elements that seemed, you know, specific to a time period, that those elements went away.
Yeah.
The songs feel, they feel like songs, like just a band playing music, which we love. And that's, you know, I think they feel believable and honest, and I'm hopeful that people will enjoy it, that they'll do that with us.
Yeah.
They'll somehow find something in those songs and go, oh yeah, now I get it.
Well, I was going to ask you like what, you know, why The Hawk in Paris? Like, why not just, why wasn't that a new Jars record, you know, with Matt Bromley's involvement or whatever, but you kind of answered that a little bit. Was it more that you wanted an avenue to explore some of your tastes and interests in aesthetics that you didn't really want to force on Jars?
Yeah.
But is there more to it than that?
And there's certainly the experiment of writing music and presenting it without the 20-year prejudice that people have from the Jars of Clay brand,
whether that's good or bad.
We wanted to, we kind of went into it going, let's sort of focus on some of the sort of darker love song kind of pop music and see what happens.
Yeah.
Which is a fun space to write in for me. I have a great melancholy bent that my wife loves. No, she doesn't. But
I do too, and that's why I connect with your stuff so much, I think.
Yeah, and so it's fun to actually get to play into that a little bit more.
Yeah. What's your favorite Jars record?
It's a good question. I think my favorite is it's probably a tie between Good Monsters and Long Fall for me. And the reason being is just those two records represent some very big shifts artistically for me. Mm-hmm. You know, Good Monsters was written in a season when I was just sort of identifying with a vulnerability that I hadn't in most of the other records.
Yeah.
And then I was also finding my way into the world of social justice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bloodwater was really getting started. So we were doing a lot more in the area of serving people in Africa and coming up in the complexity of those issues. And so we were making a lot of these declarations on that record.
Yeah.
We were working with a new creative team and they were breathing some life into it. And we were, you know, inviting people into the record like Sarah McLachlan and people like that and going, all right, this is going to be a bigger record for us. Mm-hmm. And we were coming out of a season that was really acoustic and folky. And we kind of said, we want to turn the amps back on. And so that was a great record for that. So it's a great experience. And then Long Fall was a record where we just decided to stop using all of the kind of lofty religious church language. And we were focusing on relationships. And so that record, I felt like it was an accomplishment for me to try to write with a different language, with a different lexicon. And instead of barriers or boundaries that I put on the process.
Right.
And I was very proud of that record.
How did fans and or patrons, how did people respond to that shift? Because that was a noticeable shift.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even before Good Monsters, when did Redemption Songs come out? I mean, that was obviously very clearly.
Yeah, it was right before it. That was
like a hymn, you know, worship album. Yeah. You know, but even up until then, all your stuff still definitely had a message in there. And then I do feel like with Long Fall and since then, it's you haven't been as wearing it on your sleeve as much.
Yeah,
you know,
there was a point, and I actually distinctly remember I was at this show here in Nashville, and it was this kind of variety show that happened at the Ryman Auditorium, and they would have a band from all these different genres or an artist from different genres all play in one night. and I had gotten tickets from somebody, and so I went, and I remember sitting there in the crowd and hearing, like, they would have like a folk guy get up and he would play a couple songs, mm-hmm. And then, you know, a rock and roll band would play, but then they would have a Christian artist play. And I remember that night, like, the Christian band that played, they played last.
Yeah.
Because they were the biggest of the ensembles. Mm. Like, and it was so fake and not believable. Mm. And, you know, you hear these other people writing these songs, and, you know, some of it was probably just my own bent at the time for what I was enjoying musically. But I recognized in that moment, I was like, wow. Why are the Christians being the least believable when they're talking about human experience? I remember that was a point for me to go, I don't want to be that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to be that guy who can't write a song about being a human being because I don't know what that actually feels like and I don't know how to communicate that to someone else. So there was a definite sort of shift to say, you know what? I'm going to stop using this lofty language that are these terms that are way too broad to actually be down to earth or organic, and because it's such a disservice when you're talking about human feeling or emotion or experience.
Well, I think within the church, and especially art that is made by Christians, you know, it's almost like it's negative to not have all the answers. You know, you can't question, you right. can't have doubts, you can't have uncertainty, and you don't also really want to be negative. You know,
it's music for aliens.
Yeah, it's always very positive, absolute, all the answers. You know, and I think that's where that fakeness, why that felt fake to you, because that's not what life feels like.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I mean, it's I get that for sure. You know. So. You know, do you see that? You think that's the direction that Jars will continue to go?
I think so. I mean, I think we like the space that we're in. We like being a band that, you know, there's enough artists out there, especially Christian artists, who deal with that one day where everything kind of lines up and God is who we think he is and works the way we think he works. And but then there's the other 29 days of the month where life is just a mystery, and we're hitting up against our humanity, and the tensions are always creeping in. We can't figure it out. And I think that's the space we like to write for.
Yeah.
Because it feels like life for us. And and again, back to Springsteen, write what you know.
Yeah. Well, I think we did it.
Good.
So,
sweet.
Did we? You feel good?
I feel good.
Well, thanks for talking to me, man. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for coming to Nashville and hanging in Sputnik Studio.
All right, well, that's it. That's the show. Thanks for listening. I really appreciate Dan taking the time to sit down in Sputnik Studios there in Nashville and talk to me. Had a lot of fun doing that. So thanks, Dan, if you're listening. Thanks to you for listening to this show and supporting the show. I really do appreciate that. If you want to go a step further, you can go into iTunes and leave me a review or rating, which would be very helpful. Or you can tell your friends. That's also probably one of the number one ways you can help with this show. You can help support the show financially as well by going to avclark.com/support. And I'm very grateful for those of you who have already done that. It definitely means a lot. And it helps, for sure. As I mentioned in the intro, the new show is definitely coming soon, and I'm very excited about it. If you want to get in on it, and you're into podcasting and stuff like that, then head over to avclark.com/ask and leave your voice question, and I will be in touch with you if it makes it into the show, and you'll be entered to win some pretty cool stuff that I'm giving away as part of a launch contest or giveaway, whatever you want to call it. That's it for today. Hope you have a great week. Hope you're having a great Monday, and I'll see you next time.
I'm sort of just an old guy with a big tongue. I'm just a big old tongue old man. That's all that is. That's sort of, how many words am I at?